This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 5, Episode 9, Introverted Field Settings. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we delve into the world of setting the field and how that relates to your personality and what you think about things. We also answer questions on how to improve your throwing distance and what to do if you use the wrong language when you're coaching someone. All that and more coming up on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. It's time for this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide to playing and coaching better cricket no matter what level that you're at the moment. There's always room for improvement, and that's exactly what we're here to do, to help you. My name's David Hinchliffe. I'm looking after things, and alongside me, as always, is the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield Score, and of course, former head honcho at Island Cricket. It's Mark Garraway. How you doing, Garris?
I'm very well, thank you. The sun's out and the square is cut here at school and it feels all crickety.
Well, that's very good, isn't it? It's always, you feel like you've broken through. The first day that the sun comes out and you feel the warmth of it on your face after a long winter, you feel like you've broken the back of it. That's always good, isn't it?
Exactly.
And also, our new regular, he looks after things at Portsmouth School. It's Sam Lavery. Welcome to the show, Lavis.
Morning, David. It's a nice day down here on the south coast as well. So, all ready for cricket, really, I think.
There'll be our Indian listeners and our, certainly a lot of our Australian listeners will be saying, "What are you talking about? It's makes no difference to me what time of year it is."
Absolutely. Well, it makes a big difference to us.
Yeah, exactly. When you get through that winter, it always feels good. So let's think a little bit about what's going to be going on in a few weeks in the Northern Hemisphere summer, and that is playing cricket. And in particular, I want to talk about what is one of my pet subjects, which is field settings. It's something that is one of the things that I wrote about on Pitch Vision Academy way, way back when I first started it, back in 2006. It's always been of interest to me, and I've never really ever got to the bottom of how much of it is art, how much of it is you can approach in a scientific way, and how much it takes to develop an instinct to be able to move that fielder into exactly the right place just as the fielder pops the batsman pops the ball up there. So what do you think, Garris? What's your view on the state of field placing with the way that we can analyse things these days?
Well, I think it's important to work with how you operate and how your environment operates, because I've been lucky enough to, I suppose, to work within ones that have done it purely through art all the way through purely into the science bit, having all of the bits of the equipment that that you could ever want. My personal preference is a little bit of both, to be brutally honest with you. And I think if I was asked to go between the two, I would still go back to the art bit, because the best captains that I've worked with, and strategically probably the best one that I worked with, was Michael Vaughan. We could provide him with as much of a science as possible, but often the best things that came out of field placings came from him, or from Fletch watching it just through his eyes, as opposed to anything that I bunged in. So that's my experience of it. And having captained quite a lot myself and done it all right, I suppose, I was quite into the gut feel type of things as well. And some of the things that I remember most, and other people who have played under me have remembered most, would have been associated more with that than the scientific element of it.
There is a time when something just feels like it's the right thing to do. You might not even be able to give a logical reason for it, but you just feel like maybe somewhere in the back of the mind something like that has worked sometime before in a similar situation. So you throw caution to the wind, you have a bit of confidence in yourself as a captain or as a bowler, and you say, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to change this field setting. It might not seem to be the right thing to do when it works. This is one of the things that Mike Brearley said when he did our online coaching course with us. When it works, everyone slaps you on the back and calls you a genius. And when it doesn't work, you just quietly try something else.
Well, that's a skill, isn't it? That's the art of captaincy, really. And I suppose if we think back over the winter, and some of the criticism Alistair Cook was placed under was that probably they went so far towards science, he just took it as read, and as a result became quite inflexible as a captain. And, you know, the likes of Shane Warne, who's incredibly flexible when it comes to plans and incredibly flexible as a bloke, was starting to pick holes in it. Then what tended to happen is they did some things which were completely off a wall that also didn't make sense as well. So it does come down to that, you know, that balance. But I think where Mike Brearley got that right from what you've just told me is if you do something that's gut feel and it isn't working, then have the conviction to change it again rather than just stick with it and being stubborn. And that was one of his biggest assets when he talked to the likes of Bob Willis and he talked to the likes of Ian Botham about his captaincy, was that he would try something different, but equally he wouldn't become a slave to that. And that's, you know, that was somebody who was right at the top of their game in managing people and managing a game of cricket.
Where do you come from with the slavers? So do you lean more towards the... A bit of both is probably what we're all going to say, but do you lean more towards the instinct or more towards the planning?
I think that's a better way to term it. I think art gets used as a... in a number of instances within cricket and within sport in general, and it's not a word that I like to introduce because art actually means something completely different. It's something that isn't part of a process and something that isn't part doesn't have an outcome. So invariably, none of it's art. I think ultimately, it's always going to come down to a combination of the two. I think the more people get an understanding from where instinct comes from, the more we can start to utilize it and make the most of it. An instinct and gut feel and all those different types of terminology for the same kind of way of coming to a conclusion is basically based on past experiences, and it's past experiences that are within our subconscious mind rather than with our conscious mind. Mm. And the planning is making plans based on things that we can remember. And we know that if we're bowling short and straight, then we have to fit a set of field appropriately, and we're fully aware of that, and we know that that's the way things are going to go. But there are other situations which are maybe not recorded, and we find ourselves in a situation where we think, I should try this. And actually what it usually is it's recalling a situation where maybe we've been there before, or we've seen a scenario like this, whether it's at a game or on TV, or maybe we've been in the field and we've watched a game, we've batted, and this the same situation has appeared. And something that's been tried has worked, or something that's been tried hasn't worked. And because of that, we've got some information on how we can then deliver it this time around. So it's understanding how we can use that and trust that subconscious memory, which is our gut effectively. And it's telling us, I don't know why, but I think we should try this. And as Gareth said, some people have been very, very, very good at it. And one of the big things it comes down to is exposure to the game. The more you watch the game and think about the game, the more you're logging consciously and the more you're logging subconsciously.
I do think that it's a classic, though, isn't it? You know, when you're talking about who thinks about the game more than others, how do we define that? How do we measure that?
Yeah, because, good question.
You know, some people will be quite deep thinkers and not necessarily extrovert that. And there's others that would naturally spring to mind within any environment where we can say, oh yeah, he thinks about the game a lot because he probably talks about it quite a lot, or he, you know, opens conversations up or has a strong point of view, which makes us think that. I mean, I've got one lad at school who is quite aloof actually in his body language and the way that he conducts himself. And the other day, somebody called him talented because he is somebody who hits the ball beautifully and could fall under that umbrella that people deem as being talent. And he took it as a massive insult because he said, when people call me talented, it really cuts away from the amount of time I've spent practicing on my own and the amount of time I've spent thinking on my own about the game that I love, but I just choose not to tell anybody about it. So I get that, Sam, I'm with you completely. You know, people think about it, but sometimes we can get misled, I suppose, by extroverted body language to make a decision about whether somebody is thinking about something or not, because people have different ways and modes and times that they think about something. So I'm a bit wary of when we talk about that, and I've fallen into that trap in the past, so I just thought it was relevant to this point.
It is difficult to identify who the thinkers are, isn't it? And like you say, that a talker doesn't mean a thinker, does it?
Exactly.
And so, yeah, when it comes to identifying that person who you can trust, who does have that gut feel, then it's difficult to identify who it is.
So how does that fit back into when we're talking about helping players set the field?
Yeah, I mean, what you'll tend to find is that you probably need to, if you're the captain and you're dealing with somebody who's an introverted bowler, for example, you're probably going to have to ask questions to get the answer out of them, whereas an extrovert will probably give it to you anyway. So that's something that you need to take into consideration. So, for example, I've captained a side who had three very introverted seam bowlers, and therefore my position as a wicketkeeper became quite difficult to be their captain from, because I wasn't very close to them at any given time. Therefore, I had to use my mid-off quite a lot to ask some questions to then relay that information back to me about what they wanted. So it's building strategies around what you've got and based on what position on the field you are. A lot of slip fielders are captains, and you often see Graham Smith making yards up to the bowler and making sure they're all okay, but he's also got his lieutenants around the field as well that he taps into to get that information back to him, because, you know, somebody like a Dale Steyn isn't likely, or a Mornay Morkel, classic example, isn't likely to shout their plan at you, because that's not the way that they operate. They're going to have a quiet plan, and it might take them a few questions to get that plan out in the open and then put it down onto the pitch. So that's an example of how you work with an introvert. You often talk about introverts as, if you don't know what an introvert is thinking, then you need to ask them a question. And if you don't know what an extrovert is thinking, you're not listening. And that applies in that context.
Okay, let's wrap this up with the yes, no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more we want to say. So we got those questions lined up now. And when you're ready, chaps, we'll go for it. First question. Like Phil Simmons says, Ireland is just like the West Indies.
No.
No.
Second question. Details are more important than the big picture.
No.
No.
Third question. It's better for team spirit to be the underdog.
No.
Yes.
Time now for the questions section, the mailbag, if you prefer. It's a couple of questions which are sent in by listeners to the show and readers to the Pitch Vision Academy website. And we pick one of those questions, as well as answering them, we pick one of those questions and we decide on a winner which wins a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And you can send in your questions to us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. So please feel free to do that. We've got more contact details at the end of the show. But let's go into the first question now. And the first question is from Raghav. And Raghav says, I'm trying to improve my throwing distance in the off season. I'm working out regularly in the gym, and I'm also using a medicine ball. I have a question about throwing technique. While throwing, should your front foot be a little bit turned towards fine leg, or should it be pointing straight towards the target? Our coach tells us to point it straight, whereas I saw some professional players recently pointing their foot slightly towards fine leg. Which one should I follow so as to generate maximum power in my throws? Also, should I land on my heel or my toe? So I guess when he's saying pointing towards fine leg, assuming that you're, you know, standing in the position of a bowler bowling to a right-handed batsman, not wherever you are on the field, that could be quite awkward, couldn't it? So I guess the foot slightly turned at an angle or straight. So, Lavers, what do you think?
Well, if he's looking for maximum power, we're talking of transfer of energy and getting momentum moving in the right direction, then you would say that pointing straight is an illustration that his body weight is moving forwards, whereas maintaining an angle will give him balance and will help him maintain a side-on position, but it's not going to have the same... it's not indicating that there's the same weight transfer moving forwards towards the target. So I would say that it's probably a suggestion that there's not as much body weight going forward. So that for the maximum power, you'd probably look at ideally having it pointing straight. However, at the same time, for maximum power. We need maximum range of movement, which comes from that rotation of the body and the hips and the shoulders. And that requires a starting position that it's going to be sideways on to generate or to exploit that range of motion as best as possible. So it's a combination of the two. And sometimes it's down to flexibility and sometimes it's down to glute strength that some people can't or won't point straight. And sometimes it's because they're simply standing or throwing from a standing position and they're not trying to throw maximally. Or it can even be down to they're not moving in a straight line. They're actually picking up and throwing a ball whilst travelling one direction and trying to throw another direction, which is probably 99% of the throws we have in cricket. I don't think it's something that he should be completely obsessed about, because being on a slight angle is likely to happen when we're moving different directions or when we're throwing from a standing start. But for me, if we were throwing absolutely maximally, you'd probably find it would be a little bit straighter than he's suggesting at 45 degrees.
Yeah, I'm going to chuck a curveball in, actually. I met with a friend of a show, Stephen Jones, the other day. We had a coffee and we were chucking a few things out onto the table about our thoughts on this, that and the other. And one of the things that we discussed, which Steph put onto the table and then I tried to think logically around, was having your front foot not pointing directly down the wicket when you bowl or directly towards the target when you throw, but actually slightly, which is exactly what Raghav has put in here, slightly pointing to what could be perceived as fine leg as a bowler, you know, so missing leg stump to a right-handed batter. Because what that does is it creates a better blocking mechanism rather than your foot pointing straight down the wicket when you bowl or when you throw maximally from a boundary. And that block is crucial because you put the down force down into the ground and then you receive the opposite but equal force coming back up the body. And the more stable you are and the ability to get into a stable position, the quicker that momentum will transfer from your feet up into your hips and then fire up through the kinetic chain, which I think has got something in it. So what I did was go away and have a look at baseball throwers and baseball pitchers and also baseball deep fielders that are throwing it from 300 foot to have a look at their position. And many of them did exactly what Steph talked about. And that intrigued me because it creates a better block that you can then work against. So that's that bit of a question. So I'm chucking a bit of a curvy in there because conventionally I'd go exactly the way that Sam just said. And I don't think there's anything wrong with what Sam just said. But recently I was on a conversation and did a bit of follow-up on it, which made me think that there could be another slight way to get more maximal distance. And then on the heel thing, it's exactly the same as fast bowling. You know, if you land on your heel and then go over the full time range area and mass of your foot, then you can absorb and use that downforce that you put into the ground, and then you receive it back up through a kinetic chain much more efficiently. So I'm with you on a heel contact going through the full range of movement, Raghav.
Given that then, Gareth, because I like the sound of that, I think that sounds interesting. Presumably, we still, even though we want to have a slight closing of the front foot, we still obviously want our body weight to be moving in a straight line, though. So do you think that's something that we need to retrain when it comes to throwing, in terms of actually trying to develop our footwork or our foot patterns when it comes to using that technique? Or is it something that we actually just try and move our foot in a slightly different direction? We try and step out towards fine leg, as it were, as he's discussed.
My first point of call was, if I had somebody who was doing that naturally, I'd probably let them get away with it.
Yeah.
That would be my starting point, rather than let them go and just see what happens. So they're doing that naturally. Whereas traditionally, before I had that conversation and looked at it, I might have gone down the route of straightening out the front foot just as the start of this question talks about. So it gives me a bit of latitude in that. Would I actually end up coaching somebody who potentially splays their foot? Well, I think that's down to the individual and the relationship you have with them and the way that goes, the same stuff that we talk about all of the time. But I would certainly be keen to experiment leaving the person that did that naturally, whereas maybe 2-3 months ago, I might have been tempted to go the other way. So, that's where I am at the moment. It doesn't mean to say that with experience and doing it with more people, that I might change that in the future a little bit, but that's where I am presently.
How would that work differently if someone didn't have a locked leg, as a lot of people won't do? Because obviously, if we're now pointing one direction with our foot, but still trying to flex in another direction because our body weight's traveling there, It might be something that we'd probably have to try and counter if they weren't locking their leg, as it were. So they were pointing one way, but they were bending, trying to bend still in the direction of their momentum.
Yeah, I think that comes down to the degrees, doesn't it? You know, So for example, if it is pointing to fine leg and you see that they're collapsing, I think on the front leg, I'm sort of trying to picture it in my head, but on the front leg, then yeah, that the alignment isn't allowing them to chuck or throw over a brace front leg, which is obviously a more optimal way of doing it. So again, performance comes into it, doesn't it? And what it looks like. So you tinker with it a little bit from there. To me, if you get your foot slightly pointing past leg stump rather than pointing to fine leg, so it's a real manageable. slight block. I think it's pretty manageable, but I would be very much geared by what I see. And again, one of the great video views or coaching views, I think, when somebody throws is from the side, because we get a good idea on that front leg and the way that it moves and operates.
A couple of things to think about from my point of view there. Are you talking about the position in the knee in relation to the position of the foot levers? I think you've got a little bit...
I was just considering, if you're... Obviously, if your foot's closed off and pointing to leg slip, for instance, but you're travelling forwards, then your knee is going to try and flex forwards, even though it's pointing towards leg slip, as it were. So we're just trying to make sure that that's not pointing too far wide of leg slip, because obviously the knee would then be trying to bend in a direction which it wouldn't naturally bend.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree.
I think I think how mobile your ankle is there is an important factor to take into account. If you're wearing boots which are you're a fast bowler and you're wearing fast bowling boots and your ankle's all strapped up, that's going to give you less room to maneuver compared to if you've got a lower cut boot. So the strain is going to go onto the knee then away from the ankle. So there's an injury consideration there. I mean, this is all theoretical, we don't know, but that's something to think about at least.
I mean, the human body ideally is extremely good at working in straight lines, but it can manage deviations away from straight lines reasonably well. So
certainly the ankle and the hip,
not the same impact that there would be from a fast bowling point of view.
Yeah, certainly.
And also the other thing is volume, isn't it? Because, you know, let's think about how many maximal throws we throw from the boundary and how many times that somebody bowls a cricket ball. Well, you know, if somebody's bowling seven overs a day of six balls, then you're not likely to be doing as many maximal throws from a boundary, are you? So volume does come into play on that.
And just a clarification here, just to make sure that I've got this right and anyone listening has got this right. We're not talking about closing yourself off with your leg, i.e. your legs crossing over each other. We're talking about staying aligned, the feet aligned, but just a slight turn of the foot. Rather than
very slight, just to create a little bit of a block.
Well, that's something to experiment with. And also, I want to commend Raghav for doing his gym work and doing his med ball work, because I'm sure Steph Jones would be very happy with that.
Yeah, keep doing your stretching and flexibility as well. Obviously, if he's looking to generate maximum power.
Yeah, especially the ankles, especially the hips. Lots of mobility work always helps. Okay, next question is from Stephen. He says, I recently coached an adult second team batter on a bowling machine session. After making a technical change involving a full follow through, he was cracking the ball out the middle, even bent my aluminium steps with one drive. Then I uttered the phrase in regard to coming forward or playing back. It's just about decision making now. He proceeded to immediately fall apart, mistiming or being late on every shot. Is there a better phrase to use than decision making in this context?
To me, it's not about the phrase, Stephen. I think what you've done there with the best intentions in the world is put in some interference. And you've made the batter start to think. And if I take you back to these two fellas that I spend quite a lot of time with, these two super coaches from France and Switzerland, who are beginning to have a huge impact on the way that a few of us are coaching, and I'm sure numbers of people will be coaching in the near future. They talk about coaching the intention rather than the action, because as soon as you make anything action or make something very cognitive, then people start to think. And when people start to think, their natural movement patterns go. So it sounds to me that despite the fact it was a closed session that you were doing on the bowling machine, he was flowing. He was in that natural movement pattern, and as a result was being being able to adapt to the little changes in length and line that that you were sticking up there. And as soon as we talk about stuff, which is often the worst thing that we can do, which is why silence can be such an effective coaching tool, we put a little bit of interference in there, and all of a sudden those natural movement patterns go, and those decision making elements that were so strong previously would go. So what I would tend to do instead of mentioning anything is I would just start to increase the degree of randomness, I suppose, into the practice over a period of time without being specifically sort of targeting that is what we were doing. It's a bit like if I say to you now, you know, don't think of a white elephant, everybody will have a white elephant in their head. So now it's just about decision making. All of a sudden you make that a very cognitive process, and as a result of that, the natural movement patterns of a body are no longer natural.
So the better phrase is nothing at all.
If you make someone aware that they're being assessed and analysed as to how they make their decisions, then they're going to perform differently to if they're just going about their business, making decisions without thinking that someone's requested them to do that or is analysing the way they're doing it. So Mark suggested that you can increase the randomness of the machine, which is a great way to do it, because suddenly he's forced into making decisions, but he is not cognitively thinking about them. He's not planning his decisions. He's just reacting to the ball and making decisions as they happen. Obviously, following that, you can then discuss it and analyze it and talk about how he maybe succeeded or how he could have improved. But to start with, you've got to let people try and do it on their own sometimes, or even just saying, right, let's do the same thing. We're going to take it onto a sidearm. Okay, and suddenly decision making comes in. Even if we're trying to bowl the same ball, he's suddenly aware that other things could happen. And because of that, he's making decisions every single ball, and you can then assess the manner he's doing it once he's finished his net or his bucket of balls or his three or four overs or whatever you want to do.
I guess the other question around that is if he's doing a bowling machine session and you're doing something technical, should you be talking about decision making at all? Because if you're doing a technical point on a specific shot, do you need to do any kind of decision making in that session at all?
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? Is, you know, what was the session about? And it sounds like it started off with a technical change, and to me, once you've got that technical change and you're doing that within that that session, you've got to assess whether that person, having known the person for the short or long time that you have, would be better coming out of that session with that technical change sort of ingrained a little bit more, and then start a completely new session where you were going to open it up and just throw balls or sidearm balls at them to see how that technical change that you've put in place that can then stand up to some match pressure. That's the way that I'd prefer to go around it. I think it's difficult sometimes to make that shift halfway through from technical change to decision-making within the same session for some people, because they sort of compartmentalize each of their sessions a bit rather than having it sort of flow from one into another. So giving somebody this 45 minutes, we're going to work at the technique, then having a conversation afterwards. What did you find worked for you there? Well, actually, I found that, you know, I moved very well and I made late contact or whatever the case may be. And then say, well, actually, next time, what I'd like to do is I'd like to put that into a match context and see how it operates. Then they come back and you do that. And to me, that would be a better way, because you'd be assessing their decision-making without making it particularly obvious and cognitive. And also, you could keep an eye on the technique. But that's the way that I'd operate most often with players, if I'm given, say, you know, a series of 1 hour or 45 minute sessions with them.
And it is very easy to, as a coach, to almost get a little bit greedy, can't you, and think, well, we've achieved something incredible there, that's brilliant, let's try and squeeze some more out of this session. But often less is more. Accept that you've achieved it, you've set a target, you've hopefully met it. Rather than resetting another target and trying to achieve twice as much, you can end up achieving half as much. I guess the only argument against that is how much time you have with an individual. Yeah. And ideally, as Gareth said, you're working through a series of sessions, or it's a player in your team and you're seeing them on, even in a group situation, maybe you're seeing them on a weekly basis or you're seeing them regularly. If it's someone that you're seeing maybe once a month and it's the middle of April or the end of April and they're getting let out into the season and they're about to go and have two games a week for the next 4 weeks and you're maybe not going to see them, I can understand why someone would try and squeeze more into that session. But you've just got to be realistic and is trying to achieve more going to achieve more, or is trying to achieve more or actually going to achieve less?
So is there perhaps something to be said for if something's going that well, that effectively, just say, well, we've cracked it, that's all for today, let's do something else, and literally just go and do some catching practice or something?
I think that can be the case, and it's a strategy that I've used heaps. But equally, with certain people that you get to know really well, once they've got a technical point, it's crucial that you then continue doing it for the remainder of that session, so they've built up their repetitions. Repetitions are more important to some people than others. So as long as you know which side of a fence your mate that you're working with is on, you can apply that accordingly. So for somebody who isn't that type, then yeah, you've nailed it, high quality, fantastic. If we try to sustain it, it'll probably break down a bit. So let's go and do some high catching. And for a guy that needs to, like, you know, it's 10,000 reps, it's all of that sort of stuff, then you keep hitting and hitting and hitting, rather than just changing the session slightly and risk what Sam said of going back 50%.
It's about time we had a soapbox. 60 seconds of uninterrupted talking this week. It's Mark Garraway stepping up onto the box. Let's see what he's got to talk about this week. Over to you, Garraz.
I'm going to talk a bit about my mate Graham Smith, who I was lucky enough to be a coach alongside, and we worked as a pretty good team, I think, at Somerset in 2005. We played in a quarter final at Northants, and we did our warm up and we did our normal stuff, and there was a different feel in the camp. We could sense that people were nervous, and we're sitting in the change room, we're in two seats right next to the door, ready to go out. We've won the toss, we're going to have a field and chase down the total with a bit of luck. And we both recognised that the change room was nervous and it was different. He decided to jump on top of me on my chair, dig me in the ribs a couple of times, of which I swung a couple back into his considerable side. And he picked me up, chucked me back into my chair, and then just stood up. Everybody was distracted, looked at him, and he went, right, lads, let's go out and be brilliant. And we went out on the pitch and they were 12-3 in no time, and we ended up winning the game. So he recognised the environment wasn't quite right. He changed the state, which then changed the behaviour of the team and the people within the team and allowed them to be successful.
Okay, that is the end of this week's show, but don't go away yet. We got a couple of things that we need to talk about, especially if you're one of the people who sent in a question this week, because we have to decide on the winner of this week's prize, the online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. Raghav had his question about throwing. We got very technical and geeky about that. And Stephen, we had a question about language, coaching language, and thinking about coaching. So, Gareth, which one did you prefer this week?
Well, brilliant questions. Fantastic discussion. But, Raghav, I'm going to give you the free course this week. I thought it was a magnificent question. You gave us real good detail. And also, you challenged us a bit as well, which is exactly what we ask of any of the questions that come in. So, this week, you're the winner.
Congratulations, Raghav. You get an online coaching course. Head over to pitchvision.com/academy to find out more about that. And Gareth, if someone was listening to the show and thought to themselves, well, you know, I want to get in on that action, how would they send in their question and have the chance to win the prize?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's right. Our Twitter is pitchvisionacad. I look after that, so you can contact us that way, or you can head over to Facebook, facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. And now, if you want to listen to the show every week, you can do so by subscribing in iTunes. Just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy to find us there to subscribe, or if you don't want to use iTunes, you want to use something else, then just go to pitchvision.com/academy and click on the podcast link for all the details there. Now, that's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavis.
Cheers, fellas.